Hello and welcome to another Live Pain-Free audio interview. This is Managing Editor Steve Combs, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Dr. Linda Isaacs, a graduate of Vanderbilt University School of Medicine and certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine. What makes Dr. Isaacs truly unique is her perspective on approaches to health and healing. She and her longtime colleague, the late Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, worked together for more than 20 years developing powerful nutritional-based therapies for helping those with cancer and other degenerative diseases. So if you or a loved one face an uncertain future due to cancer or other diagnosis like that, I look forward to bringing you a new measure of hope through this interview today. Dr. Isaacs, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm really happy to be here this morning.
As I mentioned just a moment ago in the introduction, Dr. Isaacs, you're conventionally trained. I mean, you're an MD. You're not just what some people might say, oh, just out there in the left field. You're actually in the annals of medicine here. And yet you're a board certified internal medicine physician who has become interested in alternative approaches. How did that come about? Because that's not the commonplace.
Well, that's right. Although I would say that I've been surprised by the number of my medical school classmates who have kind of quietly told me at reunions or the like that they do a little bit with alternative medicine too, as much as they feel that they can. But having said that, my own interest, I would say a couple of different things came into that. First of all, my mother had an interest in nutrition and more alternative therapies. And it turned out that her grandmother was actually the herbal medicine. She wasn't a doctor, but she was the local wise woman, so to speak, in her area in West Virginia. So perhaps my interest in more natural medicine comes about through that. But when I was in medical school, as a third year student, I was assigned to an internal medicine team, and the intern on that team was Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez. He was already engaged in a study of an alternative practitioner named William Donald Kelly. Kelly was an orthodontist who had created a method of dealing with cancer using nutritional ways of thinking. Kelly had created that in desperation for himself, and then people started coming to him, not because they had crooked teeth, but because they had cancer. And bit by bit, he became an alternative cancer treatment specialist. Nick, at the time I met him, was engaged in reviewing a lot of Kelly's records to see if there was something valuable there. He had certainly become convinced that there was, and I heard about the cases that he had found, and I got interested. So that's a big part of how I got involved in this work.
That's such a short story, but such a huge impact because, like I mentioned, you both worked together more than 20 years. A lot of published articles and body of work that you've worked on together. And it's not just a matter of here's just an idea. You've actually seen a lot of success with different approaches. I wonder if you could maybe summarize for us, what does that look like? What is the nutritional approach to cancer and how does that differ from, say, your traditional chemotherapy or surgery or whatever? What is the groundwork for how you approach this kind of work?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that I do believe that orthodox therapy has its place. Surgery can be curative for some conditions. Surgery can deal with potential life-threatening complications, like if someone has a bowel obstruction, for example, they really don't have a whole lot of options there. And so chemotherapy can work for some types of cancer. And actually, there's an article on my website, which is www.drlindai.com. There's an article on my website that's designed to help people think through the whole process and to know what questions to ask about the treatments that are being suggested so that they have a better idea of whether it's something that can be truly helpful or whether it's more a question of, you know, the oncologist has a hammer, so what you've got looks like a nail. In other words, I'm not categorically rejecting orthodox therapy. There are times that it can be very useful and good. Having said that, the treatment that I offer, it has three components. One would be diet. The diets can vary depending on the cancer type, but they always are involving organic food, food that's prepared at home, not stuff that comes out of a box, whether it's labeled organic or not. And no white flour, no white sugar, getting rid of alcohol, caffeine for the most part. So it's a very clean diet in effect. The protocol also involves a lot of supplements. The lion's share of the supplements are pancreatic enzymes. And I've written entire articles on why pancreatic enzymes can be valuable in cancer. And then finally, detoxification routines. Now, this is the area that can be most startling to patients if they've never heard of it before. But what we use is a method called coffee enemas on a day-to-day basis. The coffee enemas help stimulate the liver to move bile. The liver is the main detoxification organ in the body, and bile is where the liver puts what it's processed. So the coffee enemas, we believe, help the liver work better. Almost universally, our patients say they feel better when they do them. No one ever believes it when they first hear about coffee enemas. I didn't believe it myself. But once people try them, they almost invariably become convinced that they're great. So the patients don't believe me until they try it.
That's really interesting, because I do want to address something. It sounded almost like a contradiction, but maybe it's not, because you mentioned that you do advise for the nutritional side to avoid caffeine, but there's caffeine right in the enema. So how does that differ between the two intakes?
Well, for one thing, the concentration, the coffee enemas are a lot weaker than drinking coffee. Secondly, the route of administration. If you think about it, when you swallow coffee, your stomach is going to work on it. It has different effects on the body. It sticks around in your system a whole lot longer. The caffeine and the coffee enema, some of it gets absorbed, but the dose is lower. And then you almost immediately are going to expel it again. So you don't absorb nearly as much.
Gotcha. So you're not going to be like buzzing all day from a coffee enema like you might even drink a pot of coffee, you're saying.
Oh, no, not at all. And anybody that's done coffee enemas and also been a coffee drinker can tell you the way that you feel afterwards is very, very different. And they have a very different effect.
Yeah, I've not tried it myself, even though I've seen it presented, even in the pages of Live Pain Free, as a useful and therapy worth trying. You also mentioned pancreatic enzymes, and we're honestly, we're all human beings, and we would not be alive without enzymes. What makes the pancreatic enzymes different? I mean, many people think of them as digestive enzymes, and they are. But how did this come about to see, hey, we have an anti-cancer effect? Who came up with that idea? Where did that come from?
Well, what I'd say there, you know, Dr. Kelly, our predecessor in this work, he was very sick in the early 1960s. He probably had pancreatic cancer. He certainly had something bad, but this was in the days before needle biopsies and CAT scans. So when he presented to his doctors with a mass in his abdomen and a 50-pound weight loss, they would have had to take him to the operating room to make a diagnosis of a cancer they couldn't do anything about. And so they just said, this looks bad. Get your affairs in order. But he was having terrible digestive problems. And being a dentist, you know, first he changed his diet, which helped somewhat. See, dentists tend to think about food more than medical doctors. But after changing his diet, he still had a lot of digestive issues. And so he went to see a pharmacist who suggested pancreatic enzymes. Kelly started taking them not just with his meals, but throughout the course of the day. What he noticed was the character of the tumor seemed to be changing. And based on that, he then went to do a little research in the medical libraries and found the work of a man named Dr. John Beard. Dr. Beard was an embryologist, a professor actually at the University of Edinburgh. And his specialty, embryology, is about studying the very earliest stages of development. Now you might say, well, what has that got to do with cancer? Actually, a lot potentially, because the early stages of development look and act a lot like cancer. This is something that Beard is not the only one that commented on this. This was commonly talked about in the late 1800s, early 1900s, as an interesting theory about cancer. Because the early stage, for example, of development where the embryo is attaching to the uterus of the mother to make a home for itself during pregnancy, what that embryo has to do is invade into the mother's body and create a blood supply. Well, that's a lot of what cancer does. It invades and it creates a blood supply. So the way that things look and act with early stage embryo development is very similar to cancer. Beard speculated that if he could figure out what made the placental tissue stop invading and mature and turn into an organ and then peel itself off at delivery, he said if he could figure out what makes that process of invasion stop, then maybe that would be a treatment for cancer. And so what he did was look at what was going on in the bodies of the mother and of the baby in various species, including humans, but in various species. And what he found was that this change happened when the baby started making pancreatic enzymes very early in development. So pancreatic enzymes, as you mentioned in regular medical thought, are believed to only have a role in digesting food. But here is this baby making pancreatic enzymes 2 months into a 9-month pregnancy, you know, 7 months before it's going to see a meal. And, you know, nature tends to be pretty conservative. Why is this being made so early? Well, if its job is to control the behavior of the placenta, it makes perfect sense that that baby would start making those enzymes early on. So that's where the whole theory came from. Unfortunately, you know, it got poo-pooed because in the medical world, well, everybody knows that pancreatic enzymes are only used for digestion. So even though there were interesting case reports over many, many years, everybody's work got discounted because the orthodox medical world knows that pancreatic enzymes only have a role in digestion. It's only in the last 20 years or so that that has started to change. It turns out that enzymes that have similar functions to the classic pancreatic enzymes have a lot of roles in physiology. There are various receptors on the surfaces of cells that interact with the proteolytic enzymes, as they're called, the ones that munch on protein. So there's actually a fair amount of really interesting data coming out in the last 10, 15, 20 years that might make a future generation a little bit more open-minded about the concept that enzymes do more than just digest food.
Well, we certainly hope to be part of that education here, and that's exactly why we have you on today. Of course, your primary approach tends to be nutritional, but there's other aspects, I think, in all avenues of healing. So when you think about a patient, I mean, how much do like psychology or spiritual orientation, these kind of things, how do you find that fits in with a course of treatment?
Well, what I'd say there is that there's a role for stress management, certainly, and emotional aspects can play a huge role. I'm not a therapist myself, and I'm not, you know, my patients are spread all over the place. So it's difficult for me to have the types of interactions that a therapist would have. I perceive my role more as, you know, throwing out the seeds for thought as I see people. I do think that it's important, though. I think that if somebody is chronically filled with anger or bitterness or any kind of negative emotion, that it's going to be that much harder for their body to heal. So I think it's something people do need to think about. I don't tend to be particularly prescriptive about it. You know, I don't tell them, you know, you must get a gratitude journal and write 5 listings every day, although I think that would be good for them. But I make suggestions. I don't prescribe, so to speak, in that area.
Yeah, that makes sense. And everybody, you know, no one's going to have always top side. Whether you're facing a diagnosis of something major or not, we all have our days that are up and our days that are down. I think that's kind of speaks to our general attitude. How much would you say, you know, just from your personal interaction with patients, how important is that for your patients to find success based on their attitude? I mean, is that really a big factor for you, what you're really seeing in the real world?
Well, our predecessor, Dr. Kelly, once told Nick Gonzalez that healing is 100% physical, 100% spiritual, and 100% emotional. What I would say is that it's different for different people. And many times emotional stresses manifest themselves in failure to adhere to what I'm telling them to do. So how do you draw the line? In other words, if somebody is emotionally upset and if they've found that eating sugary, junky food makes them feel better and they decide to go ahead and do that, well, you know, their emotional state just made them not adherent with the physical. So it's a tough line to draw.
That's a great perspective, though, because it shows that it's an interrelation of different aspects of our who we are as people. And we have to kind of treat the whole person, I suppose you would say, because we are complex beings. And that makes a lot of sense. So I kind of want to get to a little bit of maybe the nitty-gritty here, Dr. Isaacs. I know you've mentioned a couple of times about case reports and looking at the files of Dr. Kelly, or at least Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez was. When people ask about success rates, what do you point them to? What do you look at? How do you define that?
Well, over our career, over our work with this, Nick Gonzalez and I always focus more on case reports than on trying to give people, like we saw 10 patients with this condition and five of them are still alive, that kind of data. The reason for that is that it's very difficult to lump all of the patients into a neat little box, so to speak. There's so many variables in terms of what kind of cancer they had, what kind of treatment they got, how sick were they, how adherent to the protocol were they. It just makes it very, very hard to do those kind of numbers. Nick and I actually wrote an article on this subject that's available on my website, and trying to explain why it is that I'm not going to, try to talk people into doing this program by giving them those kind of statistics. What we have instead are a lot of case reports. That to me shows what is possible, but I can't guarantee outcomes for anybody, and I can't really give you a hard and fast number for what percentage of people do well.
I think it's kind of the case with every available treatment right now for cancer and many, many kind of different various conditions. Even if you're taking a prescription of a pill for something, or you're doing a surgery or chemotherapy or whatever that is, various outcomes is going to happen because, like you said, there's going to be a variety of factors at play on the success, and not everyone's going to see the same kind of results. So I'm curious what kind of case results you've seen that were kind of notable that you'd say, well, this is kind of amazing or intriguing, or what kind of interesting things have you seen? I'm sure you've seen a lot.
Yeah, well, I have, and that's why I do what I do. If we didn't have the strong case reports, I would be off doing regular medicine. So that's why I do what I do. One of them that I like to talk about is one of the ones from the original work that Nick did investigating Dr. Kelly's work. And this is a woman who in 1970, when she was actually a fairly young woman, I think she was in her late 30s, she was diagnosed with breast cancer and she had a mastectomy. Three years later in 1973, she developed cancer in the other breast and had another mastectomy. Now, this was well before the time when anybody was talking about receptors with breast cancer or genetic issues or whatever. But here's a woman who's had cancer in both breasts before she hit the age of 40, as I recall. And this already is bad news. In 1974, a year after the second mastectomy, she was tired, she was depressed, she had back pain, she was having trouble getting dressed. And finally, after a year of complaining, they did some studies that showed that she had cancer that had spread to her shoulder blade, which is why she was in so much pain. So they removed her ovaries. That was how they would deal with hormones in those days, by removing her ovaries. But nobody said that was going to cure her. A little later that same year, she started with Dr. Kelly. And at the time that she rapidly improved, actually. And at the time that Nick was doing his research in the mid 80s, she was alive and doing great. Well, I actually decided to see if I could track her down. This was in August of 2016, and she had an unusual name, and I knew where she lived. So I went on the internet, I got her phone number, I called her up, and she was alive, doing just fine. She was 82 years old at that point. And so this is, 40 years after a diagnosis of metastatic breast cancer. So this is survival that's simply unheard of. Now, since then, unfortunately, she has passed away. I don't know what from, but she was, in her late 80s at this point. And nobody is promising immortality with this protocol, but she had a solid 40 years. And when I spoke to her in 2016, she said she felt great. And she was actually really grateful to Dr. Kelly, to Nick, and to me for continuing the work. So that was a really encouraging conversation, to say the least.
Yeah, that's very encouraging. Any other case issues you'd like to share with us? I'd love to hear some more if you have any others that come to mind.
Yeah, sure. A patient of mine, she is somebody who has been kind enough to share her story in several different locations. She is a woman who, in November of 2000, she went to her doctor because she was having a little bit of abdominal discomfort and had lost a little bit of weight. And her doctor very astutely sent her for a CAT scan. And what they saw on the CAT scan was a mass in her pancreas, a little bigger than an inch, 3.4 centimeters to be precise. She had a biopsy a couple of months later, and what they saw was adenocarcinoma, so that's cancer, pancreatic cancer. It was poorly differentiated is the term, which means it's on the more aggressive side. And there are a couple of different types of pancreatic cancer. They confirmed that it was the more aggressive kind, ductal carcinoma. Now, she was told that she could get surgery. And in fact, it was rather emphatically suggested on multiple occasions to her. But she did a little research and she realized that, you know, the surgery, first of all, she had kind of had a visceral feeling that that wasn't what she wanted to do. The surgery itself can be pretty dangerous. About 5% of people die as a result of the surgery itself. And in terms of curing the cancer, it's by no means a slam dunk. What it gives you, you know, 25% of people that get the surgery are five-year survivals. So 75% of them have a recurrence and die. And so she decided that she just didn't want to do the surgery. And she had been forceful with a number of surgeons by the time she saw me. So I didn't push her about it. She'd made an informed decision. So she started with me in March of 2001. And she is still alive and doing just fine. Like I said, she's alive. She's doing well. Now, over the years, she has had some scans that shows there's still a mass there the last time we checked. But this is a diagnosis that 20 months would be a remarkable outcome. 20 weeks is more typical. She is alive more than 20 years with appropriately diagnosed pancreatic cancer. She has never had surgery, chemo, radiation, or really any other treatment besides doing what I told her to do. So that is a very straightforward case and of somebody that's done remarkably well.
Oh, that's powerfully encouraging, I'm sure, for many listening and for me as well. So I thankfully have not had a cancer diagnosis ever in my life and hope never to have one. But it sounds like this is the kind of program that might be very helpful for some of the listeners. So who would actually be a good fit for this kind of a therapy? Is it really open to anyone, or is it something that kind of really fits certain kind of profiles? What would make sense for somebody to say, this is something I should investigate further?
Well, first of all, people have to be willing to do the treatment. I mean, what do I mean by that? Well, if somebody just plain doesn't want to do coffee enemas, there's no point in coming to see me because that's a big part of what I do. If people have a lot of trouble swallowing supplements, this may not be the best program for them because my patients take in the neighborhood of 200 capsules a day. Now, it's not all at once, it's spread out, but still, swallowing pills is a big part of this. Same thing goes with the diet. You know, if somebody's not willing to change the way they eat, this doesn't make sense. Do they want to do it? Secondly, are they able to do it? And there, you know, sometimes cancer patients, for example, have a really terrible appetite and they're just not eating or they're nauseated all the time. If any of those are issues, that this is going to be a physically very difficult or even impossible protocol. Then there are some situations where I would actually recommend orthodox therapy if it's effective. And just today, for example, I got an application from a person with a particular type of lymphoma where it's a pretty aggressive type of lymphoma, and it's one where chemotherapy actually does work most of the time. And so that's where I'm going to say that makes more sense. So those are kind of the easy things that I can say about who is not really a suitable patient. I do have a screening process in place because I don't want to take on people that can't do this or will only do it for 2 weeks and then quit. It's a waste of everybody's time. And so I'm not here to talk people into anything. I'm happy to review their information and let them know whether I think this is a reasonable consideration or whether there's a better option elsewhere.
Yeah, and I love the fact that, as you would expect a doctor to be, you're just simply open to what's going to be best for the patient and what makes sense. And so if somebody wants to investigate this further, what's the best starting point for them to find you and learn more about this process?
Well, the best starting place is really my website. My website is www.drlindai.com. And everything there I wrote myself. It's something that I put together with the goal of educating people as to what I do. So you'll find a description of the protocol with links to further explanations of why I suggest what I suggest. There's my article about deciding whether to pursue an alternative cancer treatment, which hopefully will help people walk through that whole process. And there's a section for new patients where I ask people to send in some written information about themselves. And so that will spell out what to do if somebody's interested in a protocol.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been highly educational. And I know that for many, it's going to provide a new measure of hope that we were looking for. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you. I'm really glad to have had this opportunity. And I'm more than happy to do what I can to help folks feel better and do better.
So, what did you think? Did you find this interview eye-opening, informative, and helpful? I'd love to get your feedback. Please let us know what you think by emailing us at editor@livepainfree.com or give us a call, 800-216-4908. And while it's fresh on your mind, who do you know who could really benefit from what you just heard and learned? Go ahead and please share it with them. Our mission here is to completely transform the way people think about and care for their health. So please help us reach even more people. Everyone deserves the best chance at optimal health and wellness. And if this interview was shared with you and you are not a current Live Pain-Free member, head on over to our website, www.livepainfree.com now and sign up for a free trial membership. I'm certain you'll find it one of the best investments you make in yourself. Thank you again for listening, and I wish you love, peace, health, and happiness.